Welcome back, everyone, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because as a mediator and a document preparation company, that's all I do, amicable divorces. I am so thrilled to have Dr. Talal Al-Saleem, a licensed marriage and family therapist, and an author of a book that you absolutely, unequivocally must get if you're listening to this episode. The title of the book is Infidelity, and that's the title of a two-part episode we're going to do with Talal. Infidelity, the best, worst thing that could happen to your marriage. The complete guide on how to heal from affairs. This is incredible. I just love this, Talal. And Talal, as a licensed marriage and family expert, is an infidelity recovery specialist. Infidelity is no easy issue to just brush off the table. When there's an affair that's out in the open, the betrayed tends to want to shut all communication, right, Talal? Shut all communication down, totally blame their partner, and rush to end the relationship. And it sounds something like this. I bet you've heard this a million times in your practice. How could you do this to me? I trusted you. Don't you love me anymore? After everything I've done for you, how could you do this to me? It's over. I'm taking the kids and the cats too. But Talal, you're suggesting a more thoughtful approach that will either end the relationship in a way in which the betrayed and the betrayer can enter a new relationship with improved awareness of themselves and the ability to trust someone else while identifying issues that could lead to infidelity again. Or, and this is the hardest part of all that you're going to help us with, remain in the relationship and use the infidelity to create a stronger relationship. Is that really possible?
Well, Judy, thank you so much for having me on your amazing show. Infidelity is my passion, and I'm always eager to share my knowledge and skill set with folks, especially about such a devastating topic as you have described. And you're spot on in terms of how most people usually respond after the discovery of an affair. But you are correct in terms of infidelity doesn't have to be that traumatic event that should last for eternity with a devastating impact on our life. It can actually be a positive catalyst for change, a change that will lead to a better relationship with ourselves and potentially a better relationship with our significant others who are involved in the infidelity event that we are dealing with. Now, that doesn't mean that I prescribe infidelity as a cure for my clients, right? But I see it as a crisis that could actually lead to creating an opportunity for making long-awaited changes.
Give us some stats. The percentage of marriages that experience infidelity.
So, you know, the current survey is 41% of marriages when both spouses report either being involved in a sexual and emotional affair. And again, it's a very staggering statistic because if you think about it, that's almost half the population of folks who are in committed relationship. There is a disparity, a slight disparity between differences of how often males and females commit infidelity. The jury's not out on that one. I think a lot of it has to do with how males and females define infidelity. But I would say the numbers between males and females are, you know, whatever gap that used to exist between the prevalence rate is actually shrinking.
Well, in your book, you said 57% are men and 54% are women, which I really found quite surprising. Somehow we look at men as being the culprits in our society, don't we?
That is correct. And again, historically, this has been kind of the view. And, you know, and one thing I'm always an advocate for when anybody involved in any kind of research, especially about a complicated topic such as infidelity, they need to go outside of the discipline. I'm a big advocate of interdisciplinary research. So when I do my research about infidelity, I don't only look in the psychological literature as well as the clinical work that I do, but also I look at what anthropologists and sociologists say about the topic to kind of get a global understanding of the issue. And sociologists have attempted to kind of explain why historically there has been this disparity between males and females' prevalence rates of infidelity as it pertains to gender and power dynamic in societies. So one of the explanation in terms of how come the statistic that we have seems to be pretty close is that, you know, we are getting closer and closer to potentially someday we have more equality between the genders. But my suspicion in terms of the closeness of this prevalence rate is that, again, we're not just counting sexual affairs, we're counting emotional affairs. And if you look at it from a broader perspective, when you count sexual and emotional affairs, I think you'll see the numbers are kind of going to be somewhat equal. Now, again, there is also this tendency to believe that males tend to be more engaged in more sexual affairs in comparison to females, but also I'm seeing in clinical practice that trend has been changing lately too.
So, any reason why?
Well, I think, again, our view about sexuality is changing. We are taking better steps toward embracing sexuality and not shaming people about sexuality. That doesn't mean it's always going to go to manifest in a healthy track, right? But I think a lot of it has to do with our social view about sexuality and sexual expressions and male and female relationship is changing and evolving.
You said something really interesting in the beginning of your book. I believe it was on page 11. You said two things that I would love for you to explain more. You said deceit and trust cannot live side by side. And then you talked about the purpose of marriage as fulfilling the emotional and physical needs of each other. So could you talk about that a little bit, please?
Sure. It is my firm belief that a successful relationship that we have with our partner, spouse, significant other should fall into the same kind of category of business partnerships. And if you think of business partnerships, they're based on a relationship contract that specifies the number of partners in the relationship, the types of emotional and the type of needs are going to be fulfilled in that contract. But more globally, if you think about partnerships and in terms of the needs that we have as humans, we all have the capacity to live by ourselves and fulfill our own emotional and sexual needs. Could we do it? Sure, we can. But to me, it's a quality of life. Life is a lot better when you partner with somebody else who can help fulfill some of those emotional and physical needs. Which again means that if you are engaging in any kind of committed relationship, there need to be a discussion of what kind of relationship that we have, how many partners in this relationship, and what are the emotional and physical needs that are expected to be fulfilled in this relationship. And to what extent there is an exclusivity of the fulfillment of those needs. Because again, we live in a big, beautiful world where there are many different models of relationship that does not require emotional or sexual exclusivity. So this is the contract piece and the fulfillment of physical and emotional needs within the confines of the contract relationship that we have with our partners. The flip side about deceit and trust, in any kind of successful kind of partnership, you cannot have a successful partnership if you don't trust your partner, even if it's a business partnership, right? If you don't trust your partner, you cannot work as a team, which means that is there really any room for deception? If there is deception in any kind of relationship, does it really create an environment that would foster trust? So the two cannot coexist the way I see it, right? If you're deceptive, you cannot expect your partner to trust you. Just as simple as that, because if you cannot share the truth, whatever that truth is, no matter how unpleasant it is to hear, you're not going to be able to recruit your partner help in whatever mission you're working on.
So that leads me to this next question, which I think everybody struggles with if they find themselves as the betrayer, and that is to tell or not to tell your partner. I think in the book, you support telling, and by the statement you just made, ultimate trust, I kind of think that's where you're at, right?
Well, that's one of the biggest challenges in fidelity counseling in general, from the clinical standpoint, as well as from the client's perspective. Not only the average person will not agree on whether or not it's best to tell or whether to take the secret with you to the grave, but also I think a lot of clinicians are split on this. There are some clinicians who feel, well, who cares about telling? Why can't we just try to repair their relationship or the individual issues that led to the infidelity without disclosure? Or if we're going to give disclosure, you know, what good was going to come out of that other than traumatizing your partner? For me, disclosure is important, not just on the individual level, but also for the betrayed partner. So this is not just for the sake of the betrayed, but also for the sake of the unfaithful partner. We'll take a look at from the unfaithful perspective. A lot of times what I notice is that even when I'm working with a client individually in the absence of the betrayed, when you give the unfaithful the opportunity to tell the story of what happened and you ask them the right question, in that moment, in that whole process, you see them, you witness them making discoveries for the first time about their intentions, their thoughts, and feelings that they were not aware of throughout that whole time when they were engaged in the infidelity process. Now, that doesn't mean that those thoughts and feelings were not there. It's just that they were there, but they were they were able to rationalize them, justify them, and put them on the back burner. So there is a therapeutic value just for the unfaithful on their own from their vantage point to be able to tell the story and have an opportunity to engage with a seasoned clinician who will actually be able to ask the right question to help them make sense of what they did and why they did it. So that's the value for the unfaithful. But from the betrayed perspective, they need to know why this happened in order for them to rebuild trust, because this is where this is where people get stuck for the most part when it comes to healing from infidelity. They decide to rebuild their relationship. Is that, how do I trust this won't happen again? Well, if you don't know what happened, why it happened, you don't really have an anchor to rebuild your trust then. So to me, that would be the value. But even let's say if then people saying, you know what, we don't have to worry about trust because if I don't say anything, then my partner's not going to know. So we don't have to worry about trust because if they don't know, they're not going to lose trust. But what if the infidelity was caused because of a relationship deficit? How are you going to fix this relationship deficit with your partner if you actually don't have a meaningful conversation with them? We'll zoom out even further than this. Let's say that as the unfaithful, you decide not to tell your partner about the infidelity. The third party, which is the term that I like to use for describing the other man or the woman in the affair, they're their own human being and they have their own internal drives and motives. So even if you take your secret to the grave, you have a wild card who may or may not share all this information, but also engagement in sexual or emotional affair with somebody else are going to have some tangible consequences. And those consequences are going to impact the betrayed, whether you tell them or not. Whether it's STIs, whether it's losing your job because you were having an inappropriate relationship with an employee. So eventually it's going to impact the betrayed. So I feel also they have the right to know, because what you're doing on the side is going to impact them directly or indirectly at some point in time.
Oh my gosh, you're absolutely right, because I was thinking of two different movies. I think they're both with Michael Douglas. One with Michael Douglas and Demi Moore. She was his boss and they had an affair at work, and then Michael Douglas didn't want his wife to find out. And then Michael Douglas and Glenn Close, where Glenn Close wouldn't let go of the affair and then, entered the marriage of Michael Douglas, and I forget who was his wife at that time. But those movies are two great examples of what you just said. Wild card.
I'll do you one better. I'll give you just one of the most recent example of a client I just been working with just last week. Husband and wife. Husband is the unfaithful partner. He's an addiction specialist physician. He got involved with somebody through his support group who needed detoxing services. So there was poor boundaries between his role in recovery and this female in his recovery group. And, you know, it was a brief 3-week sexual affair. But, you know, when the wife discovered, there was all, you know, the third party was not ready to end the affair. And, you know, the third party, you know, is somebody with a checkered past. And the wife complaining about, like, she said, you know, I used to have this life with white picket fence, safe neighborhood, didn't have to worry about anything. But now, because I know this third party is somebody who has a checkered past, who have made threat, now I have to lock my doors. I'm having to install cameras. My whole life have changed because I live in fear because this third party is threatening me and my husband because he's ending the affair. So again, who you involve with, right? Yeah, third party. Could potentially not only impact the unfaithful, but also impact the betrayed.
And we don't really use our best judgment when we're involving a third party. We're really acting out of a thoughtless motivation. Right, we don't evaluate very well, and we really don't know people. I mean, you don't even know your partner until you spend years with that person, right? And you go through situations and life. It unfolds. We unfold in front of each other.
I appreciate your pause on this, Judy, you know, especially when you say thoughtless. So it's never thoughtless. It may appear thoughtless at the moment. It's a lot of times people are aware. It's just they manage to somehow to override or minimize those potential concerns, which pretty much lead to the same conclusion. It's kind of really the impulse to act override the thought and the logic about the consequences.
Yes, the word impulse, that's what I was missing. So I guess to answer the question to tell or not to tell, I guess it is better to tell, because to find out by accident or find out on your own, the betrayed, probably worse maybe in the aftermath than actually being told, because then you mitigate that third party and whatever that third party may want to do, correct?
Perfect. So another yes, but let me qualify this yes. So it is better to tell, but also part of the barrier is people have a misunderstanding of what does it mean to tell the story, right? A lot of people feel that disclosure means that you have to show every nitty-gritty detail that would cause unnecessary images and details. That disclosure doesn't mean showing everything every moment. They are important part of the story that will help us understand what happened and why it happened. And there are some part of detail of the story that are really not necessary and only going to create unnecessary images and thoughts in our head. So sometimes that's the hesitation about disclosure, is that I'm saying disclosure, you're asking me to traumatize my partner for life. Not necessarily. You can have disclosure in a healthy, therapeutic way. But again, bring it back to, you know, is it always best to disclose? Yes, if it's done properly. But also, when the unfaithful, in the rare circumstances in which the unfaithful actually disclose on their own, it has tremendous therapeutic value for the betrayed. Because the betrayed would say, okay, this is hurtful, this is traumatic. But they interpret the disclosure as a sign of somebody who really didn't want to do this, somebody who really wanted to repair their relationship, and is going to help them in terms of the rebuilding efforts of regaining trust, because they at least say they showed initiative. They didn't have to tell me. I could have found out from somebody else. Now, assuming that the sharing and the disclosure was done for pure motive, if you want statistic on this, I would say 96% of the time, the unfaithful is not the one who's disclosing this. It's found out, right? You know, it's a small percentage in which the unfaithful actually decide to disclose on their own. And out of that 4%, I would say in the majority of time, the motives for disclosings are usually selfish and trying to contain the fire because they know somebody's going to out them and they're trying to beat them to the punch. There are rare circumstances, I'm not saying they do not exist, they are rare, in which the unfaithful truly, you know, coming out because they say, I'm tired of this, I really want to put this behind me. But majority of the time, it is discovered.
So the desire to stay in the relationship, but to make the relationship better in some aspects, that's in the minority of motivations, do you think? What do you think?
No, that's different. I'm talking about specifically that, you know, the motivation behind telling the story. Because I would even argue, disclosure or non-disclosure, there are a lot of unfaithful. The reason that they are being unfaithful is because they still love their partner, but they can't figure out a way to address the needs that are missing in them, whether it's individually or a relationship. And rather than saying, you know what, let's divorce or let's separate and be a free agent, they decide to, you know, have both worlds. So I would even argue that sometimes in a crazy way, infidelity is an act of love. I love you so much, you're not meeting my needs, right? But I don't want to let go of you because I still want you in my life, having given up hope on us working together, but I have those needs are not being taken care of, so I'm going to outsource them to somebody else. Again, and these aren't the scenarios in which infidelity happening for a relationship deficit. That's not always the case. Sometimes we all have seen there was a relationship where somebody have the perfect partner. They seem to be compatible. Their partners fulfilling their emotional and sexual needs, and somebody's still unfaithful. Sometimes infidelity happens because somebody's dealing with individual issues, which I'm sure we're going to talk about.
Right. I wanted to segue right into that. This is perfect. So on page 36, you talk about the factors that make people more vulnerable to infidelity leading into the causes. So please go ahead now with that.
Sure. So, when we talk about infidelity and theology of it, it's important to look at it from three different facets. There is relationship issues that could lead to infidelity, there is individual issues that could lead to infidelity, and there's also sociocultural issues. And all of these factors, three factors, they kind of interrelated, right? So they kind of influence one another. But if we're talking about resiliency, right, who is at higher risk of inviting infidelity in their life, and we're just looking at the relationship issues, it's oftentimes the couples and the individuals who have difficulties in assessing and expressing their own needs, emotional and sexual needs, is the couples who have difficulty communicating effectively about those needs. It is the couples who are have difficulty in making compromises and negotiating to meet each other's needs. And it's the couples who are failing to adapt to positive and negative life stressors that could come into their life and prevent them from meeting their needs in the way that they're expecting to. So these are kind of like the resiliency factors that we look at in terms of who has higher chances or lesser chances of inviting infidelity to their life.
Okay, so could you take us through the causes, there are many, of infidelity?
Sure. So let's start with relationship factors. So there is this myth that infidelity happen because people are not happy in their relationship. Now, relationship dissatisfaction is one of the leading causes of infidelity, but it's not the only one. But if we're looking just at the relationship factors, that the first common relationship issues that could lead to infidelity, it's poor communication, right? So how is your partner supposed to meet your needs if you don't communicate effectively about those needs? You know, a lot of people, I think, sometimes expect that their partner to be a mind reader. And sometimes people say, well, if I communicate about my needs and I tell my partner what I want and they do them, then how do I know they're not doing them out of obligation? And I always say, well, you know, they have their own free will. You know, they could say no. Just because you say it doesn't mean that they have to do it. So expressing your needs does not mean you're obligating your partner into forcing them doing them. You're simply telling them, this is what I want. Another factor is it's poor conflict resolution skills. So there are a lot of people who are good about communicating their needs, right? They tell their partner, you know, what are their emotional and sexual needs, but they're not good at conflict resolution. They're not good at making compromises needed to actually fulfill these needs. So that presents a different problem. Another common relationship issue is the failing to adapt to life stressors. The best example that I always give is that you have you know, a couple who were happy and fulfilled in their sexual life, but then they decide to, you know, either adopt or have a baby. And then they make one of two mistakes. They either expect their sex life to be exactly the same as it was prior to having the baby, which is unrealistic, or they give up on that completely. And again, I always tell couples that when you have a new stressor in your life, whether it's positive or negative, you need to pause and talk about how we're going to meet each other's needs, whether it's sexual, whether it's emotional, in the light of this new stressor, right? Because you cannot give up on it just because you have this new stressor. You just have to talk about how we're going to re-envision this part. It's going to look different, right? And it's going to look different in a way. But if we agree on how do we adapt to this change, then there would not be any resentment, because we all understand that, you know, well, now maybe we cannot have sex in the same frequency that we used to, but we all on board that this is what's attainable because of this new stressor, and nobody resent everybody, and nobody feel that they're not desired, and nobody feel that their partner lost interest. That's, I would say, one of the common mistakes that people kind of deal with. And you see it with other facet of life, you know, when somebody's getting a new job or have to commute or somebody's going back to school, all these things that we invite to our life kind of affects how we meet each other's need.
Well,
so I would say, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was going to say that these are the, you know, some of the common relationship issues. I would say another big one is compatibility.
Thank you. I was going to ask, did you marry the right person or not?
This one is huge. So there is no rule in the success relationship rule book that says in order for you to have a happy relationship that you have to be exactly like your partner or you have to be a carbon copy of them. I think, you know, I think differences actually enrich life. So I'm not saying, when I say compatibility, it doesn't mean that you exactly have to have the same interests, the same likes, and aligned in every way. What I'm talking about is that as long as the differences that you have with your partner are not significant to the point where it causes conflict. And there are some aspects of life in which polar opposite differences can lead to problems. You know, I mean, let's just look even politically nowadays. Politics broke up a lot of marriages, right? When you have people who are polarized on either end of the spectrum of the political identity, that's going to make them difficult to have meaningful relationship, meaningful interactions. If we're talking about compatibility intellectually. So I worked with a couple, husband and wife, been together for about 30 plus years. They were happy. Both of them worked in corrections. When they retired, the wife decided to enjoy her retirement, and the husband decided that, you know, he wanted to go back to school and get a PhD in criminal justice. So he went on this journey, intellectual journey, and he got his PhD and he started, you know, teaching at the college. And all of a sudden he began to feel there's an intellectual gap between him and his partner, right? He became dissatisfied. He felt they cannot have meaningful conversations. Before, they were buddies. They worked in the same, you know, facility. They were able to relate to one another. Intellectually, we're aligned. And now he's this intellectual giant, so to speak, from his perspective. He began to find her as somebody who's not intellectually stimulating. So he ended up, you know, having an emotional sexual affair with a fellow college professor. So, which brings us back to when we talk about compatibility. Compatibility, sometimes people from the get-go are not compatible, but sometimes people are compatible early on in their relationship, but we all change and grow and they change in different direction, which brings us back to talking about the compatibility that's from the get-go. And again, and this has to do with, you know, people not taking the time to figure out who they are, what they like and dislike, and taking the time to find the right partner for them. But even when you do all this work, just because you find somebody who's compatible, you need to be aware of how the two of you are changing and can the two of you continue to be compatible.
Absolutely. I attended a seminar for the Southern California Mediation Association some years ago. And this one particular workshop was presented by a therapist and an attorney. And they were talking about compatibility. What makes people compatible? So they ran a video of different couples who had been married for quite a long time, like 50 years, quite a long time. And what each and every one of them said was the differences in their partners didn't bother them. And I think about the toothpaste example, that the little logistical things of how we keep house, how we execute our days, that in and of itself can set the other partner off. And they just said it comes down to small things sometimes, and then it's also big things like how you deal with money. And in my business of divorcing people and mediating for people, their settlement agreements, it's not infidelity that's the A number one reason why people get divorced. It's financial. People are not on the same page regarding how to manage money, how to make money, the ability of both people to earn money consistently. It's how we support ourselves. So that's a big part of our life, which leads to compatibility as well. And it really leads to sexual desires, I think. Where do you sit on this?
Well, tell me first about the parallels that you see on your end in terms of sexual desires and the financial conflict and compatibility.
Well, it's when children are born. It really changes the dynamic of the relationship. A, you need more money in order to support the children and the family and to grow, because we are expensive as we grow up. And if that's not rock solid, that affects the allure, the attraction of the other person, and therefore the sex goes out the window. I can't really address those things because I'm not a therapist. I just have to accept and know how to move beyond that to get a settlement agreement done.
Perfect. I think you're spot on in terms of we're looking at root issues, right? Not like we're saying, you know, kids are the destroyers of marriages. That's not what I'm saying. I think, again, it's having children and growing family actually one of the bigger assets to strengthening a relationship and strengthening the partnership. But to me, what stands out is what? It's a chain reaction of, you know, we have this new stressor. We don't agree on the same page of, you know, it changes our life. And maybe we're not on the same page in terms of how we're going to adapt to making these changes, right? Because I really think a happy life does not mean that you don't have struggle. A happy life, a happy relationship, a relationship that would survive struggles as well. It's a relationship in which both partners truly have the same vision of the stressors ahead of them, and they know for a fact that both of them are doing the best they can to survive that stressor, right? If they're on the same page and there is a beginning and an end to that, right? Let's say, like, you know what? We all, you know, we need to make more money because X, Y, and Z. I need to go back to school for 2 years. It's going to be rough. I'm going to be, you know, you're not going to see me as much, but we all know that this is what we need to do. Not because I say that what we need to do. We both agree that this is the decision we do and we have to make some certain compromises or sacrifices. If we're all in agreement on what these sacrifices and compromises are and it has a beginning and an end and we have some creative ways to still meet each other's need, then we can survive this and come out stronger, right? It's when you have these people where they make unilateral decision, whether it's financial, whether it's occupational.
Just cut out, Talal. And I actually don't know how to bring it back. Okay, so you just cut out for the past 30 seconds. It's how to resolve. I think that's where you left off. Okay, so everybody listening, this is where Zoom is very difficult to deal with. I don't know why you're cutting out on your end, Talal. But you are. So until we get Talal back, I'm going to pick up on this a little bit. What he said about poor communication and poor conflict resolution skills is seriously important because, first of all, I deal with this in mediation every single day. This is the cornerstone of how we relate to each other in every situation of life. It is how we communicate and how we resolve any issues that we have that come up. So then we look at infidelity, and we look at how infidelity comes into the picture when your communication skills are not good and your conflict resolution skills are not good. One of the outs, so to speak, is infidelity and having sex with somebody else. So I think we have Talal back. Talal, are you here? I have you back, right, Talal?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you now. So I just kept talking while you were getting back on board, and here's what I said, and sorry to repeat to the audience. So I picked up on, you said two very important things. You talked about poor communication skills and poor conflict resolution skills that can lead to problems that foster infidelity. Therefore, and our out, our easy out is sex with somebody. That's how we relieve ourselves. Do you agree or disagree?
I agree to an extent. And you know, I was going to tie this back to your question about the sexual desire, right? And we were talking about, you know, having kids and financial struggles and how these kind of tie to one another. So here's the thing that we need to think about when we're thinking about sex, right? A lot, and you know, whether guys want to admit to this or not, different story. Sex is not just about the physiological release. A lot of it has to do with how emotionally I'm feeling connected with my partner, right? So if you have resentment to your partner because they're not meeting your needs, or they're not working with you collaboratively and resolving this life stressor, whether it's parenting, whether it's job, whether it's finances, it's going to create that emotional distance between the two of you. So which means that it's going to decrease the quality and the quantity of sexual interactions, right? Now, again, because we have this decrease emotional intimacy, which will in return decrease the physical intimacy, those needs are not going to go away, right? Just because they're not being met, it doesn't mean that I'm not going to have them. And people kind of begin to start thinking about different ways to fulfilling those needs outside the relationship. So yes, also, you know, sexuality in general can be a quick fix for an escape, a release. But I think a lot of times it's the issue of not just that, well, I need somebody to have sex with us. Sometimes it would be nice for me to be desired. I work hard to provide for my family and my partner at home is not appreciating me, right? And here's the somebody else that maybe I work with, and we're going to talk about affairs in the workplace, right? You know, who have the same struggles, they don't feel appreciated. You know, I want to be desired. I deserve to be desired. So it's not just about the sex piece. It's about really emotionally, I want somebody who values me and appreciates me. And being sexually desired is one facet of getting that fulfillment.
Okay, so true. And I do live my life through movies and stories. And I remember this one scene in Sex and the City, the movie part one, where Miranda and Steve had, I don't know if they had a child yet. But anyway, Miranda was the lawyer. Steve worked at night. He was in the nightclub business. And Miranda just wanted to get it over with. And so Steve went outside the relationship to seek physical fulfillment and I guess emotional fulfillment. It's such a good thing you said. And he went to Miranda. He felt horrible. He did not want to be with anybody else. She, of course, did the typical, okay, I'm out of here. And her girlfriends on the show made her look at her own culpability, pushing Steve away. So, and how did that make you feel? How do you think Steve felt? You're pushing him away. You have this high-powered job. That's more important than Steve. But he told you, and he said he wanted to be with you, and he wanted to work it out. Classic example.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up because, again, I do believe, you know, reality does inform entertainment and vice versa. There is a bidirectional relationship between what we see in the movies and reality, right? So that's not far-fetched. So this set the stage for me to talk about this, again, controversial aspect of dealing with infidelity. A lot of people don't like to hear that that sometimes the responsibility of infidelity is not just on the unfaithful. And a lot of people kind of confuse what that means. So I'll say so that as clear as I can, so that people get the right idea. Infidelity, the unfaithful is 100% responsible for the actions that they took, right? But that does not mean we should ignore the reason that led to the infidelity. And I always tell my clients this: as far as I'm concerned, nothing that I have seen. Or we'll see, can justify or excuse infidelity, but does not mean we should ignore the reason that led to it, because everything happened for the reason. But like I said, identifying the relationship factors that led to infidelity, it does not mean that I'm blaming the betrayed. I'm just saying that, everybody had a part to play. Because if we look at the big picture, the unfaithful had choices. Even if you have the worst partner in the world, you have choices. Go take them to counseling or say, I'm done, before you cross that line. So really, nothing should push a person to go beyond that line. But again, it didn't happen in a vacuum, right? So when I say the responsibility of the betrayed, I'm not saying it's their fault that the infidelity happened. It's that there was a part that was played. Even if the infidelity happened for an individual reason that has nothing to do with the relationship factors, right? There would have been some signs. How come we didn't see those signs? Did I select the right partner when I saw those red flags? What did I do? Did I take the right steps to address that issues? Because you can't have two people in a dysfunctional relationship without the other person knowing, right? Now, I understand we're all different in terms of how perceptive we are in terms of relationship deficit. But also, if you're living with somebody who's struggling with individual issue, right? If the relationship is healthy, you're going to be aware of your partner's individual struggles, right? Even if they're dealing with a mental health issue that has somehow played a factor into their infidelity behavior. There should have been some signs. How come I wasn't aware of this? How come the relationship wasn't healthy for my partner to be vulnerable enough to share their struggles with me? So either way you look at it, there has to be some kind of a part to be played on both partners. It takes two for a relationship to either start wrong or start healthy and, disintegrate into a dysfunction.
Well, I can really understand your position that infidelity can be the best, worst thing that can happen to the relationship, because in a situation where the betrayer comes to their partner, before somebody becomes the betrayer, that's how I want to say it. Before somebody becomes the betrayer, if there's a dysfunction in the relationship, and let's just say there's no sex, the other partner does not want to participate in intimacy, and the soon to be betrayer comes to that partner and says, look, I think we have a problem. I really would like to be more intimate. You are not. Can we see somebody? Can we talk about this? And then it seems to me, and I may be wrong, but it seems to me that then the soon-to-be betrayed says, well, you just don't understand. I don't have time. I have all this pressure. And then all the reasons are there. So I guess if infidelity is going to happen because the opportunity to seek counseling at that point when there's an when the soon-to-be betrayer identifies that there's a problem and they're not getting the reaction of, okay, let's talk about this, then you're booked. And then this could be the best, worst thing, because there is something we have to deal with. Maybe you didn't want to deal with it last week, but we got to deal with it now.
Sure. But I'll outline to you the three scenarios this manifests, that specific piece that you talked about, if the unfaithful try to resolve this issues. So, one, it's either that there was lack of awareness of a relationship dysfunction. That happens. So sometimes people aren't even aware that there is something is missing, right? Two, poorly expressed, not communicating about the relationship issues. Or three, communicating about it and not resolving it, right? These are kind of like the three ways that manifest. like said, because sometimes, you know, I've seen some clients where they say, okay, well, I tried to tell you. It's like, what do you mean you tried to talk to me about this? And when you ask them about the detail, when was that? And you're looking at it as an outsider, it's like, well, that doesn't sound like a clear, direct way of expressing that something was missing for you. Then you look at another couple when they can pinpoint, it's like, no, I specifically on this day, I told you this is an issue. I'm having struggle with this. Can we fix it? And you gave me some of these answers of like, no, I can't. I'm busy and all of these things, right? So what usually happens in those scenarios, the betrayed would say, well, yeah, you did talk to me about this. I know you are unhappy, but I didn't know you are unhappy enough to the point where you're going to be unfaithful. So that's a whole different layers of it.
Absolutely.
Right? Because you say, well, I know that things were bad, but they were not that bad. And that's what people need to take. The take home message here is that just because something is not that bad or not that level yet, it doesn't mean it's not going to get there, which means that you need to be taking your partner's concerns seriously. They don't have to say, hey, do this or else I'm going to cheat. That's not a way to have a relationship. That's that's ultimatums.
Okay, so you touched on this. Let's explore this a little bit. Mental health issues mental health issues.
Perfect. So we talked about some of the common relationship factors that lead to infidelity. Now we talk about the individual factors that sometimes is not related to the relationship issues. And listeners need to be aware, and this is my disclaimer on this, just because somebody has this mental health issue does not mean that they are unfaithful. Are doomed to be unfaithful. It just means that they might have a higher probability due to the struggle of their symptoms. So it's very important that we don't stigmatize ourselves and the people that we know. So a common one is bipolar 1, bipolar 2. And this one has to do with what, in order to have either of these diagnoses, you have to either have a manic or hypomanic episode, both of which have the symptoms of impulsivity and reckless behavior that sometimes take the form of emotional and sexual affairs.
I never thought about that.
And sometimes that can also be a relationship factor too, because, you know, not dealing with the mental health condition improperly can put a stress on the relationship and causes dissatisfaction as well. So it can be an individual as well as a relationship factor. Another common diagnosis that I see is folks with personality disorders. I would say that the top two would be antisocial personality disorder, and the antisocial would be engaged in fidelity simply what? Because the antisocial have complete disregard to the right of others in general, but specifically to the right of their partner in the relationship. They know what kind of exclusivity contract they signed with their partner. They simply don't want to follow the rules. So therefore, they're going to engage in those behavior and not lose sleep over it. The narcissistic personality disorder is very common as well. And one of the main hallmark symptoms of narcissistic personality disorder is this need for constant attention. Is that, you know, even if their partner might be giving them the appropriate amount of attention, it's not going to be enough because they need it from multiple sources to feed their ego. And another aspect of that specific personality disorder is this sense of I'm unique, I'm special, I deserve special treatment. So I shouldn't play by the same rules that my partner plays with. I'm going to allow myself to have more partners. You will also see borderline personality disorder. There is a high prevalence rate of infidelity, and this is related to the instability in self-image, as well as this constant need to keep your partner in the relationship with you. And sometimes this goes beyond the threats of self-harm. This could take the form of, I'm going to give attention to somebody else to make you jealous so that you won't leave me or that you stay with me. So these are kind of some of the common personality disorders that have higher prevalence rates of infidelity.
Hello, I have one quick question about this. So sure. With the borderline, is this where you might find domestic violence?
Yes. And again, those relationships tend to be explosive and there are poor boundaries. And a lot of times if you dig deeper, you will begin to see that the relationship didn't even start on the healthy footing in the first place. Versus that started on the right foot and then devolved into dysfunction.
And then the other two that you had named and that are in your book, sexual dysfunctions and addictions. Yeah, let's talk about that.
Sure. So I actually, one of my workshops that I teach clinicians to do is infidelity beyond the lens of addiction. It is very important for the average person as well as the clinician to make a distinction between sex addiction and infidelity. There is correlation, but again, there are two distinct pathways when we look at the two. So when it comes to addiction, there is two layers of it. There is sex addiction and there is substance abuse issues. Now, again, clinician will tell you sex addiction is not in the DSM-5. It's not in the diagnostic manual because researchers don't believe there's enough empirical evidence to support a diagnosis. But we all have seen signs of sex addiction. So to me, it's real because I see it in my clinical practice. So when you have somebody who struggles with any kind of sex addiction or hypersexuality, they tend to have higher rates of infidelity simply because of the nature of their symptoms. But also, when you have people who have substance abuse and dependency issues, the common theme between substance abuse and dependency issues is what? Is that usually there is impaired judgment and poor impulse control, especially if somebody is not in recovery. When you have poor judgment and impaired judgment and poor impulse control, you're going to be more likely to cross those lines because there's a lot of people who fantasize about infidelity and they don't act on it because of the consequences. But when your judgment and impulse is impacted, it's going to be easier to cross these lines. Another important topic to talk about is exposure to sexual abuse as children. This was one of the most interesting finds that I came across in my research. There was a recent study that showed that survivors of exposure to sexual abuse are 4 times more likely to be unfaithful in future relationships. That's like really huge number in terms of predictor of future infidelity. And if you think about it, it makes sense. There is a lot of correlation between being exposed to sexual abuse as a child as well as infidelity, specifically when it comes to this taboo, desired, dirty secret that we have to hide. So when we're exposed to sexual abuse as children, it affects how we develop. It affects our sexual identity, affects the type of attachment that we have. And research shows that oftentimes, again, especially, and again, there's the many different factors, has to do with who's the perpetrator, what kind of intervention we're provided during that time after the exposure to sexual abuse. But it could lead to instability in the sexual identity as well as in reckless, impulsive sexual behavior. And that's why it's important when, you know, when I work with my clients, I don't just look at the infidelity when I'm doing my assessment. I look at family of origin, history of the relationship, and clinicians should be really doing these things because complicated just doesn't happen simply because you're not happy with your partner. That's just one of the zillion reasons that could lead to infidelity. So these are kind of some of the common individual factors that could lead to infidelity outside of the relationship issues.
What about societal and environmental factors? For instance, there are cultures around the world, and because we're a multicultural country, we inherit the cultural norms from other societies that may look at a man, a male-dominated society, having mistresses, and that's just part of life.
Great question. So sociocultural and environmental factors are one of as a source of causes of infidelity, is the one that's oftentimes ignored in infidelity research as well as clinical practice. So I'll share with you some of the 3 main ways that sociocultural factors can lead to this. The first one we need to talk about is cultural norms. We all belong to macrocultures or microcultures, right? Macrocultures could be nationality, ethnicity, religion. Microcultures, it could be what profession that I'm in. It could be what specific small group that I belong to, and it could be my family of origin. So each culture that we belong to, whether it's macro or micro, have its own set of cultural norms. And cultural norms are what? Pretty much the blueprint that tells us what's appropriate or what's not appropriate, right? It's just kind of the laws of the land. These are the rules that guide social interactions. So if you're part of a cultural group that has a cultural belief or norm that doesn't frown upon infidelity, doesn't see it as a big deal, or and sometimes they see it as a sign of masculinity, right? You're macho because, you know, you have multiple sexual partners, then you're more likely to engage in fidelity because simply it's not frowned upon. It's part of your cultural belief system. Like, that's what everybody does. Most interestingly is like, you see this in occupational setting too. So there are like, you know, if you look at the certain jobs, so I'll start with this. There's a website called Ashley Madison. And for those of you who don't know this, this is a website for people who wants to have affairs. And I believe in 2014, there was a data breach that allowed researchers a golden opportunity to analyze a big set of data about who's on these websites, what kind of jobs they have, what kind of income that they make. And they found out that certain jobs had to be more highly represented on those websites, which means that there are some occupations that has some cultural norms as well as unique stressors that could cause this individual to have more higher prevalence rates of infidelity. So again, same disclaimer, just because somebody have this job, it doesn't mean they're unfaithful. It just means that, you know, they have higher probability of inviting infidelity to their life. So one of them is the military. Folks in the military tend to have higher prevalence rates of infidelity. Now, there is a component of this is related to cultural norms, that this is what everybody does when you're deployed, right? When you're deployed, that's what everybody does. But also, again, not everybody, but at least that's part of the justification that people use because they see their, you know, colleagues engage in the same behavior, so simply it's not frowned upon. But also there's an aspect of this as well. You're in a different state, different country, so who's going to know, right? Another aspect of this that's related to environmental factors is the ratio available between men and women. So if you're away on a base, there's not enough men and women to go around in the military because there is a representation ratio, right? So there's not even enough people to go around. So you're looking about, you know, more males competing for limited numbers of females, which open up the potential for having multiple relationships. So these are just some of the, you know, environmental factors that people need to kind of think about when they think about infidelity that's not always related to that. But I'll bring it back into a different cultural norm. One of the clients that I recently worked with, husband and wife, husband is the unfaithful partner, and he's an executive in a tech company. And when I asked him, like, what was one of the motivation, and he said, well, this is what everybody does. He said, I'm an executive and I earned it. All CEOs in my industry, they have a mistress. So that's kind of what everybody does. So there is a part of it that allowed him to kind of justify that. Now, obviously, there was some relationship issues going on between him and his wife, but it made it easier for him to have the cultural norm was where, like, all my friends have mistresses. This is what we do when we travel. So it wasn't that big of a deal, or I was able to justify it.
That's interesting. And then there's one other thing that you were talking about in the book, and then when we did a pre-interview, and that is there are jobs, cultures, work cultures, where coworkers form almost life-saving bonds, nurses, doctors, firemen, policemen.
Yes. So here's another aspect, too, about the occupational piece to infidelity. There are certain jobs. Oh, I mean, we all have heard this joke about you have a work husband and a work wife, right? And sometimes people take that line even further, right? So there are certain jobs when in order for people to survive, they literally have to have a very strong bond with their partner. And sometimes these jobs, usually what they have in common is what? Long hours, exposure to trauma, frequent travel. And that's put a lot of stress on the relationship, but also sometimes make them feel alienated from their partner, especially if their partner happened to be civilian, right? Work with firefighters who say, well, I don't want to come home and talk to my, you know, my wife or husband about what I see, all the stuff that I see. I don't want to have to relive it, which means that they don't have an outlet to talk about work stressors with their partner at home. But also they might be able to talk with their colleagues at work who also struggling with the same relationship stress, and that bond even become more blurred and stronger. And you keep in mind that you know, trauma bonds people. When people survive trauma together, it really forges that bond and it becomes bigger than a friendship. So eventually the relationship that people develop with their peers at work becomes stronger and more fulfilling than the relationship that they have with their partner at home. So it becomes easy to cross those lines.
I can't believe the hour has gone so quickly, but we've come to the end of our hour for part one. And when we come back and do another episode next week for part two, we're now going to really focus on why infidelity can be the best and worst thing that's happened. We're going to talk about why the story is important to reconstruct, and you're going to really show people what to do when they have to answer the question to stay or not to stay and how that process works. But this has been a wonderful hour. Thank you so much, Talal. Now, you're in Sacramento, right?
That is correct.
How do people get in touch with you?
They can find me on the infidelitycounselingcenter.com or talalasleem.com.
Okay, say that one more time, please.
Sure. So they can find me at the infidelitycounselingcenter.com or talalasleem.com.
All right. And when I do show notes on this, your name will be spelled out as well as your book. So thank you so much for joining us. You have been listening to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces with Judy Weigel, your host, amicable divorce expert, because I love, if there's going to be divorces, I love them to be amicable divorces. You can reach me at my email address, judy@constructiveuncoupling.com, judy@constructiveuncoupling.com, or through my website, divorceresourceinc.com, divorceresourceinc.com. This ends part one, but please join us next week for part two. Take care, everybody.